Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of January 21st through 28th. I'm happy to have with us Father John Parris from Boston College. Father Parris is a teacher in the theology department, specialty ethics, and we thought we could perhaps talk about some concrete examples that you deal with on a day-to-day basis in your work in this field, one of which is dealing with young children with severe disabilities. Maybe you can talk about that for us.
One of the odd things is, as a Jesuit, I've become somehow or other an expert on very early gestational age, low birth weight babies.
Okay.
My only experience with that was having been one myself.
Oh, were you?
But it's very problematic. The age in which now children can survive has moved way down from, it used to be 26, 27 weeks, down to 23 weeks, even 22 weeks. But these children are born with a great deal of problems. And the real issue is, who makes the decision about these issues? Generally, of course, it's the parents speaking on behalf of the child. But what we've learned is that children are not just chattel. They're not just the product of their parents. They're not just the property of their parents. And you can have good, caring, loving parents making terribly bad decisions for their children, not because they're evil or because they're bad, but because they lack knowledge or they're fearful or they're frightened. And the question is, how do you protect the interest of the child when the parents are asking, first, to stop a treatment that really ought to be given, or to continue treatment when, in the eyes of the physician, there's no possibility of the child surviving, and the parents are simply holding on out of hope or out of prayers for a miracle, and the child is suffering. And probably one of the worst of these cases was a case that we had in Texas about a year and a half ago called Son Hudson versus Texas Children's Hospital. Son Hudson was a child born with a severe genetic problem called thanatropic dysplasia, very small congenital dwarfism, small rib cage, underdeveloped lungs. The doctors were convinced there was no possibility of the child surviving. They were the physicians at Texas Children's Hospital, an extremely advanced pediatric hospital. And they were convinced with the ventilator that the child was slowly suffocating to death. The mother said the child is fine. The doctors don't know what they're talking about. Now, there were some problems with the mother. She believed that this child was not conceived of human parentage. She believed that his father was the sun in the sky, and as long as the sun was shining, he would thrive. So she says, keep going. What are the doctors to do when the mother's demanding the treatment and the doctors think it's causing suffering and burden on the child with no possibility of benefit? Now, generally, that's an unresolved question in our society. The big battle on this actually went on at the Mass General Hospital at the exact same time, 2 years ago, in a case called Howell versus Mass General Hospital. A woman enters the hospital in 1999 with severe ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. She says she wants everything possible as long as she can appreciate her children. They treat her and continue to treat her. She communicated by moving her fingers, eventually lost muscle control, then communicated by eye blinks, lost control of her eyes, had one eye removed. Now the doctors are convinced that she's non-responsive, and the daughter says, oh no, she appreciates my presence, keep going. After 3 years, the Mass General doctor said, this is terrible. Now what made it worse was, the daughter refused to allow any pain medication to her mother, including Tylenol, on the grounds that this would affect mother's alertness, and that was the reason for keeping her going. At this point, the Mass General did, as hospitals tend to do, they went to court seeking court direction as to what the appropriate care for this woman would be. They believed they should stop the ventilator and allow her to die, that she could no longer communicate. She was conscious, but she couldn't communicate. She was responsive to pain. She groaned and moaned, and the daughter would allow nothing. The case went to court, and here's one of the problems. Courts want no part of these cases. Judges want no part of them. The Mass General petitions the court for review of the case, and the probate court in Massachusetts schedules a hearing 8 months from now. You know what they're doing, hoping she's dying before they get to it. The judge has a 3-day hearing and then waits 2 months and issues his order and says the daughter should act in the mother's best interest. Keep on going.
Yeah.
And the judge rules it's not unreasonable for the daughter to withhold pain medication because this would dull the mother's alertness and thus the rationale for continuing to operate. Now, the ethics committee, which was headed actually by Dr. Ned Kasem, a Jesuit and the chief of psychiatry at the Mass General, said, this is torture. This is not Auschwitz. We're the Mass General Hospital. This is outrageous. But the court says, keep going. Now, in the face of that, and they went on for another 2 years until finally the mother dies in the hospital. Texas, and it was George Bush who signed this legislation, said.
So when was that case? Just
they were both 2 years ago.
2 years ago, okay.
In fact, three big cases going on at the same time with Terry Schiavo, Sun Hudson in Texas, and Howe in Massachusetts, all at the exact same time.
Interesting. And the other two you heard very little about in comparison to the Schiavo case.
Oh, very, very little.
Yeah.
Although, and we'll come back to it as to how Schiavo got affected what happened in Massachusetts. But Texas had a statute that I say George Bush signed saying if you have an irreconcilable dispute between the family and the physicians over what should happen, and the physicians believe that treatment should stop, and the ethics committee reviews this and agrees, then the family has 10 days to find another facility willing to treat the patient as the family wants. Okay. And if they cannot effect a transfer during that time, and the hospital is charged with assisting them in finding another facility. And in Sun Hudson, they called 40 other pediatric hospitals in the United States, including most of the major pediatric centers in the entire United States. As you can imagine, none was willing to take this case. If after 10 days the family cannot transfer the patient, then the obligation of the treating physician to continue treatment ceases. In the Texas case, the Texas Children's Hospital actually went to court. They weren't required to by the statute, but they said, we don't want to look callous. We don't want to look to be taking advantage of a mother who's not fully mentally, as they put it, might have some mental problems. Mm-hmm. She, in fact, had been admitted to a psychiatric unit for 3 days after the birth. And the court ruled the statute is clear. We're not telling you you must stop. We're not telling you not to stop. We're telling you the statute says your medical judgment is to prevail unless they can find a physician willing to do it. Now, what's interesting about that statute, and when you talk to judges about it, is if this case actually went to court, and you say to the judge, Your Honor, here's the case, and there's not a single identifiable physician in the United States willing to treat the patient the way this family wants, what's the legal issue? Well, there is no legal issue.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, Madam, you've got a problem. But it's not a legal problem, and this court can't solve it. And furthermore, the fact that not a single physician in the entire country is willing to do what you're asking ought to give you a clue that perhaps what you're seeking isn't medically appropriate. So what you have in Texas is a procedural-based way of handling irreconcilable disputes. It's efficient, and it works. The alternative is, as we had in Massachusetts, going to court. Courts are enormously reluctant to intervene. And in fact, no American court has ever ordered the withdrawal of treatment over family objections. It simply never happened. And I know of no judge who's willing to go home and say, yeah, I just signed the death warrant for a patient.
Sure, yeah.
Their answer is let the appeals court handle this. They don't have to see the crying patient's family.
Yeah. Well, this raises the question. I mean, I guess traditionally in medicine, perhaps 40 or 50 years ago, it seemed that a lot of deference was given to the doctors in terms of their judgment. But we've certainly moved to a model that's very patient-centered, and for good and a lot of reasons. But in cases like this, you can see the effects when you leave it up to people who maybe don't have the capabilities or may have other issues. These problems can occur.
Well, there are several, lots of problems. First of all, 40 years ago, there wasn't much the doctor could do, even if he or she wanted to. Ed Pellegrino, who's now the chair of the President's Council on Bioethics, but an enormously distinguished physician and bioethicist, wrote a history of medicine. And he said you can divide all the medicine to three eras, from Hippocrates to 1960. That's a pretty good sweep.
Yeah.
but nothing much had changed. And said all that the doctor could do, and you could always identify the doctor, he was the one with that little black bag, everything he could do, and it was always a he in those days, everything he could do was in that little black bag, namely, not much. 1960 to 1990 is the second era, and everything changed. First, technology. Enormous change and shift in technology. Now we have technology that can intervene, but a lot of it is what he would call halfway technology. It can prevent death, but it can't restore functioning existence. Secondly, third-party payment for everything. With Medicare and Medicaid coming in the 1960s, somebody else is paying. And as David Eddy talks about this distinction now between value and cost, was enormous value to the family with no out-of-pocket cost. And the result is nothing's too good for granny, as long as Blue Cross pays.
Sure, right.
If you went to this same patient at the Mass General and said, now it's costing about $4,000 a day to keep your mother in here, you reach into your pocket and pay $4,000, you wouldn't find her there very long.
Yeah.
And the third thing, of course, and the most important shift, was in the 1960s, and primarily because of Vietnam, the loss of trust in institutions. Instead of being the source of truth and certitude, we found the government was a cesspool of lies. Institutions lost their credibility, and medicine among them, and autonomy and self-determination became the only value. The motto of the day, trust no one over 30. That is, the source of truth was every individual. So now you've got a system in which there's enormous emphasis upon self-determination.
Sure, yeah.
There's enormously effective technology which can at least preclude death. And there's very high expense which is not personalized. And you have the recipe for what Pellegrino calls chaos.
Right, it's a perfect storm.
Perfect storm. Mm. We seem to be incapable of resolving it. The great unaddressed issue in healthcare is cost. No one willing to even approach the issue. No political figure today willing to approach the issue. The thought is somehow, and Americans believe this, that every individual is entitled to whatever medical treatment he or she wants, and cost is no object.
Now, we were talking earlier about these two cases in Texas and in Massachusetts. Can you just let us know how those were resolved?
The Massachusetts case was resolved very interestingly. The Mass General decided it would follow the Texas model and went to the family and said to the family, we are going to give you 7 days to find another place for your mother. She's been here now nearly 6 years. The daughter immediately went to court seeking injunctive relief to preclude the Mass General from doing that, and the judge, the same judge who had earlier ruled keep going, issued a one-word statement, denied. So the lawyer for the Mass General calls and says, where does that leave us? And I said, that leaves you on an ice floe heading south. The court said, I'm not going to tell you not to shut it off. But the court didn't give you any authority to shut it off. The daughter says, I am the durable power of attorney for my mother. I'm the healthcare proxy. I say don't. And this is where Schiavo comes in. The Mass General had, in a case a year earlier called the Gilgun case, refused to treat a patient over the daughter's objection. The mother dies. The daughter sues. There was a 2-week trial in the Superior Court in Massachusetts. And the court came back, the jury came back, saying, we believe that what was requested was futile. We believe that the woman would have wanted it. We believe it's futile. And we believe the doctor had no obligation to provide it. But that was a trial court judgment. There was no appeal in that case made, so we had no precedent. Now the Mass General is faced a year later, 2 years later, with the exact same issue. But at the moment, Schiavo is going on down in Florida, creating all of this. When the trial judge denied the injunction, the daughter did what people do in America. She went to the press. She called a press conference, and I got a call from CNN saying that there's a woman about to appear on the steps of the Mass General and going to denounce the hospital for planning to execute her mother.
Oh, gosh.
At which point I called the attorney for the Mass General and say, are you aware of what's going to go on the steps of your facility this afternoon? He said, what? And then with Schiavo and the hundreds of millions of dollars that the Schindlers were getting from the right-wing groups like the Bradley Foundation, the Olin Foundation, for all of those.
This is her mother's family.
Terry Schiavo's parents.
Parents, right, yeah.
All of those appeals in the Florida courts and in the appeals court and the federal court and the Supreme Court, those appeals cost hundreds of millions of dollars. Where did all that money come from? It came from groups that had a political agenda. And you say to the Mass General, you can just imagine now what will happen when this case gets the publicity.
Right.
They will all come up saying, we have to stop the Kennedy-Kerry murder in Massachusetts. So the Mass General has now got a real serious problem. How do we stop this publicity disaster from befalling us? The daughter's got an interesting problem. Namely, she's afraid the court will order the cessation of the ventilator this afternoon. So they go back to court. The hospital goes back to court saying, judge, tell us what our legal authority is to stop the treatment. The judge, being a judge in a trial court, doesn't want any part of this. So his answer is, settle it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the lawyer calls and says, how do we settle the issue that is, we want to stop on Tuesday, and she wants to go on forever.
Right.
What's the compromise between next Tuesday and forever? And the compromise actually was 3 more months of intensive care, at which point the guardianship would revert back to the court from the daughter. So the daughter is happy, mother is not going to have the ventilator shut off tomorrow, and the Mass General is happy that the press conference is no longer going to be on because we have a new press conference that has 2 points. The daughter says the Mass General is one of the world's best hospitals and giving mother everything great, and the Mass General says this is a caring, loving daughter whose concern and commitment is to her mother's well-being, and we'll have no further statements from either side.
So what happened? Did the mother...
26 days before the expiration of the extension, mother died.
Wow.
Just what the court hoped.
Yeah, exactly. And then you had the case involving the child in Texas.
The child in Texas, that case went to court only because the hospital wanted clarification. They weren't taking advantage of a mentally compromised mom. The trial judge said the hospital was free to stop the treatment if it wanted to, but he wasn't going to order it. That was appealed, and the appeal went up on grounds of an issue of recusal on the judge, a technical issue. The appeals court sent it back. It was resolved. The case again goes before the same judge. He issues the exact same ruling. No further appeal was taken. The ventilator was shut off, and in moments, the child died.
Okay. All right. Now, there was one other case we were discussing earlier that I thought would be helpful for some of our listeners out there, and this involves couples who were just struggling to decide what to do with a child who is tragically, this is a child who is still in utero, but who has some serious medical issues, including some who have, as you call, lethal abnormalities. Maybe you can describe one of those cases.
There's a series of cases, and they're terrible tragedies for couples, young couples, caring, loving, committed couples wanting a child, and the diagnosis comes back through prenatal care that there's a lethal abnormality. The child either has an encephaly that is born with no brain in the 28th day of gestation, the neural tube didn't close, it's well known, and this child has no brain. These children, 65% rather, die in utero or die in birth. Of those who survive, most die within 2 weeks. There's only been one case, the famous case of baby K in Virginia, where the mom insisted on ventilatory support where the child survived and did survive for about 2.5 years. But that was a very distinct case. You'd have other children with renal agenesis, no kidneys, failure to develop lungs, various lethal abnormalities that are diagnosed in utero. And the question comes, and I received a question like this just this week, must we take this child to term, to 39 or 40 weeks, or can we deliver it earlier? Now, there's no question, upon the diagnosis, the family is immediately confronted with the recommendation from most physicians to terminate the pregnancy immediately. There's no possibility of this child surviving more than a week or two outside of the uterus. There's going to be suffering on the part of the patient. And, for example, at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, when we did a survey a few years ago of this issue, 32 of the 33 diagnoses of anencephaly were terminated within a day or two. Alternatively, you will find couples, primarily Catholic, but also evangelical or Baptist, or any strong proponents of right to life who believe and morally are committed to the proposition that abortion is wrong, it's evil, they won't consider terminating the pregnancy. And the question first came to me several years ago, many years, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I think. I was at the Woodstock Center in Washington and staying with Dick McCormick, who was without question the greatest of the Catholic medical ethicists of his day.
A legend.
A legend, well-deserved. And we received a phone call from the Chancellor of the Diocese of New Hampshire. And he said, we have a case here in the Catholic hospital of a woman diagnosed in the 22nd week with anencephaly. Do you know what that is? I said, yes, I do. He said, and our question is, must we go to term or can we deliver in the 26th week? I said, Monsignor, that's an interesting question. Why the 26th week? He said, because that's the point of viability. Now, actually, this case was at least 25 years ago because we've advanced a great deal since then. But it was 26 weeks. I said, you're absolutely right. You can deliver. Now, you've got to be careful about the terminology here. They talk about terminating the pregnancy. Every pregnancy is terminated, either with a delivery or a C-section. So don't use that as the determinant as to what you're talking about. The question is, when may you deliver a child early induced delivery? I said you can do it for the well-being of the child, and we have lots of induced deliveries of children. You can have C-sections, or you can have an induced delivery of the labor. He said you can do it at the point of viability. Right. Now the question is, when is the anencephalic going to be viable? The answer, that is, able to live independently with medical support outside of the womb? The answer, never. When may you deliver this child? At any point that you can induce the delivery. It has already reached, as McCormick puts it, the zenith of its capacity for life, which is zero. Now, pathophysiologically, you cannot induce the delivery till about the 22nd or 23rd week. It just doesn't work that way. You can have the delivery in the 22nd week. Now, I've dealt with this recent case, I think is the 6th or the 7th I've dealt with of these couples, all Catholics, all quite conservative, all committed to not having an abortion, all committed to having a live birth and the baptism and the funeral of their child. They've all named their child. In all of these cases, they talked with their obstetricians, many of whom were somewhat surprised at the proposal that they came up with, but whom, when they understood it, understood the benefit to the child was going to be baptized, understood the benefit to the parents, they were going to hold their live child, understood the benefit of the whole situation, that this was a child cared for, loved by their parents, and given the best possible option that it faced, namely caring, loving parents, baptizing it, holding it, and giving it a Christian burial. And in all these cases, around the 23rd or 24th week, the woman would enter the hospital, would be induced using not prostaglandin, which is an abortifacient, but using Pitocin, which is used for every normal delivery. The child was in each case born alive. The child in each case was baptized. And I presided over the funeral of two of those, and they were two of the most moving funerals I've ever attended. Yeah. So there is a way, short of saying to the parents, you simply have to go for the 40 weeks. And it's called early induced delivery of a non-viable fetus.
Okay. Well, I think that points to the expertise that Catholic ethicists can bring to the medical field, a different perspective that perhaps doctors wouldn't ordinarily think of. And it's important work that you do, and we thank you for sharing some of your counsel for us, and hopefully it will be of some help to our listeners. We want to thank you again for joining us for this week's edition of the American Magazine Podcast. We're on a bi-weekly schedule in February, so we'll be joining you again for the issue of February 4th. Till then, you might want to check out online our new blog, In All Things, which is available on our homepage. Or if you'd like to subscribe to our podcast, you can do so via our homepage or at americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.